just make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with verses 22 and 23. Solomon asks another rhetorical question. What does a man get in all his labor and his striving with which he labors under the sun? And again, they've left out here the prefix lamed with the noun heart. Now, what's the heart? What does he get out of this emotionally, we might say? What's the soul consequences? Because all his days are pains, literally, and his task, vexation or provocation or irritation. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This, too, is vanity. Point one here, Koheleth now asks another rhetorical question, which is designed to underscore what he has just stated in verses 18 to 21 about the fact that one cannot take anything with them from this world. Two, the force of the question is to reinforce his conclusion that it is all a waste of time, since man ends up with nothing for all of his hard work. And again, whatever sense of momentary satisfaction you might take in the job or joy you take out of it or, all that in a job well done, that's you're still not taking that with you. And the fruit of it all, you're not taking with you. That's, again, why they've added that phrase or that term in there, rightly so in the New American Standard, that it's the fruit of the labor. It's what you construct with your labor and all that. Well, three, the question anticipates an answer of nothing. Alternately, the answer might be, well, it's worse than nothing. Four, when one considers the fact that in the future everything will be lost, left to others and their whims, it leads to the conclusion that there is no use in striving for anything. And again here, his logic, is this good, sound logic? Does it follow logically that since you're going to leave everything behind, that there's no point in doing anything? And if you adopt that attitude and that viewpoint, you're going to find yourself living on the street. Why bother with a job? Why bother with accumulating? Why bother getting a house and all that? Because you're just going to leave it to somebody else. So alternately then, your best deal is to just be a street person and don't worry about anything. You don't work. You don't accumulate anything. You just try to get, from meal to meal, essentially. Is that really a lifestyle that would be satisfying either? I don't think so. So five, the language here is slightly different, but corresponds to the original question that was posed in 1:3. Coming full circle to sum up the reasoning behind his view that everything is pointless. And again, as we pointed out, his initial statement here in verse 2 of chapter 1, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. And then he makes his assertion here, tells you his conclusion, and then gives you his reasoning as to why it's all vanity. And that begins really with verse 3, with his first rhetorical question. What advantage, what gain, what profit does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And so then he begins, and the answer, of course, the question there anticipates a no answer, none. He's going to tell you, and then he cites all the cycles of nature and the endless cycles and repetitions of life. Then he tells you about his own experiment. And all of that, and now he's kind of come full circle and asked the question again: What do you get out of it all? What's the purpose? Three, he uses the noun amal, toil or labor, which he has used extensively in the first two chapters. Again, the term focuses on the unpleasant aspects of hard work, the labor, the unfulfilling nature of toil under the sun. Seven, in this case, he adds another phrase, which adds something to the argument that has not been presented to this point. Eight, the New American Standard translates the phrase, in his striving. However, the emphasis is on the longing, the striving, or the ambition of his heart, which focuses on the mental aspects of toil and labor. What motivates people to go out and do things? There's some sort of ambition there. There's some sort of drive within them. That causes them to do so. They have this motivation mentally, somehow, in their soul, that expresses itself in all these sorts of projects, like Solomon did. And so, nine, we all know that men do what they do in this world based on some inner motivation that inspires them to a particular course of action. And 10, for all his mental attitude, motivation, mental planning, and overt work, man essentially dies and leaves everything to someone else. So the logic, again, if this is all true, if these are indeed the facts, and they are, I think the facts are indisputable here. His basic suppositions are correct. You're going to die. You're going to leave everything to somebody else. But does that logically lead to the conclusion that it doesn't matter what I do now? Does that logically lead there? No, it doesn't. There's a flaw in that logic. So, again, it's true enough, though. You die. Somebody inherits everything you've got. 11, the logical conclusion to all these depressing facts is that it is not worth the bother. Why bother with anything? And some people, you know, for whatever reason, some people are the opposite of Solomon. They're unmotivated. They don't really want to work. They don't really want to support themselves. They don't really want to apply. But even that person, let's face it, whatever they do manage to get, which will be much less than, say, what Solomon got. And again, I would love to, hopefully, since we will be outside the realm at some level of time and space in eternity, I would love to be able to look and see all this stuff that Solomon did. I think it'd blow you away if you could actually see all his work. And again, there kind of gets to be this point where his very works mock him. How beautiful they are doesn't even appeal to him. He just looks at him and he sees nothing. Oh, it's just a project I did. And then people are oohing and aahing over it. Oh, this is gorgeous, you know. This could be one of the seven wonders of the world type deal. And so men have done some tremendous things, as we know. But Solomon looks at all this and he just says, big deal. So what? And again, I think I'd like to have seen it all. I just got to believe it was outstanding work. And he takes no pleasure in it, though. He's consumed with the thought that, well, it's done now. Who gets it? Not me. I'm going to die. So 12 here, Koheleth now introduces the rationale behind his question in verse 22, which is designed to strengthen the fact that a negative response is in order. 13, the phrase all his days is to be understood as an accusative of time and could be translated as during his lifetime. Every day, again, the whole of it, day in, day out, however long you live, all his life this happens. This is man. And this certainly is this true of every person at all times? Well, no. But we all know enough about this verse, I think, to know, or we've all maybe experienced enough about this verse, to know that, yeah, there's a truth here. There is a truth here. What he does, and I suspect, I'm just, again, he doesn't come out and say so. I suspect he's talking about how he felt about it. This is what he got for all his hard work. He talks about a man in general. But again, when he talks about an heir in general, I got to believe in his thinking, he's got to be thinking of his son. And when he talks about a man in general who's done all this stuff, he's got to be thinking at some level about himself too. That, yeah, I did all this. This is his view on what he got out of it. So again, this phrase could easily be translated as during his lifetime. 14, he makes two points about people and the reality of the physical and mental aspects of work that make it so unpleasant. 15, the sentence characterizes the life of people that work hard during the day. And then moves to describe how these same people often spend their nights. This is seen in other portions of the scripture. This is not just in this, quote, depressing section of Ecclesiastes here. We see this in other parts of the scripture that there is a certain difficulty to life. It's acknowledged in the Proverbs. David bemoans it sometimes in the Psalms about the difficulty of life and the struggles he faced. And not always so much in David's case about his work, but it was about his enemies and how they came at him and wrote him off and all this and that. So 16, while he has regularly been using the Hebrew word amal, toil, he now reverts to the term inyan. Which is task or occupation, which he had used in 1:13. This word is a little more neutral in that it doesn't emphasize so much the unpleasant aspect of what you do or the hard, difficult aspect. It just emphasizes what you do, the task or occupation that you're engaged in. And we saw it in 1:13, I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that was done under heaven. It is a grievous task. It's a word task there. But there he characterized it by the adjective evil. And so what is this grievous evil task that this horrible God has laid on the sons of men? What is it? And it's trying to figure out life. What does man do? What does he spend his time doing? It's trying to make sense out of it all. Trying to look at it and say, okay, well, this happened. Why? You know, why does evil happen in the world? Why do innocent people suffer? Why are oppressive regimes allowed to live and all this? And you can ask, you know, why is the conspiracy allowed to continue? Why doesn't God shut it down? You know, there's oppression out there, injustice and all of this. And what does man try to do? He tries to make sense out of it all. He tries to look at it and say, well, what's the point of all this? Where's this headed? And that's another whole issue that we're going to get when we get into chapter 3. You've got this issue of time, and man is stuck in time. Now, God, however, is not. God lives in eternity. And so for God to look at things from his perspective, he sees it very much different than we do. At the very best, all we can see is little pieces of it here and there. Kid Rock, I know all of you probably like Kid Rock, but he has this song called Lonely Road of Faith. That's a good song. It's one of his better ones. I don't like most of his stuff. And he says, one of the lines in it, he says, we try to make sense of the pieces that we find. So you're trying to pick up, as it were, the pieces of life, and there's a puzzle, and you're trying to put it together, and many times people just don't get there. They just don't see it. But why don't they see it? Because they're looking at it from the wrong perspective. If you look at things strictly from a human perspective, you're never going to see the work of God in all of this. There has to be a looking at things from a divine perspective. And ultimately, of course, the human race tends to be arrogant. We know that. It's characterized by arrogance. That's Satan's favorite tool. Of course, that was his favorite sin, was pride and arrogance. That's what brought his downfall about. He wouldn't humble himself. He was proud. And so the idea here is the arrogance of the human race makes it figure out that it can figure stuff out. Well, if the wisest guy that ever lived couldn't figure all this out, what do you suppose your chances are? And the answer, of course, is, well, less than nothing, probably, since he couldn't do it. Or you can run around and tell everybody, I'm smarter than Solomon, I figured it all out, if you want to take that approach. I don't think I am. But Solomon is looking at this strictly at this point in his thinking. As he holds up this younger Solomon, he got consumed with the human viewpoint aspects of all of it. He's not factored God into any of this. You haven't heard him mention God. And again, when he does, we're going to see that he just starts off with acknowledging God's sovereignty. But that doesn't bring him pleasure. That bugs him. Why? Because it's God's plan. He's in charge. He controls the times and seasons. And yet there's this desire of man, by the very formation of man's soul in the creation, when God created man in his own image, there's this thing in his soul, and Solomon refers to it as eternity. He's got eternity. God placed eternity in their hearts. There's this part of man that wants to figure it out. There's a part of man that understands time. Certainly we all understand time. Seconds, minutes, hours, tick, 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 there it goes. And so if we can understand time, we can understand the concept of endless time. I mean, we understand these principles like mathematics. We get number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then we recognize there's negative numbers. Well, the timeline of time goes infinitely in both directions, just as the timeline of numbers goes infinitely in both directions. And so man has this idea of infinity within his soul that he can grasp, that he knows about. And so as he's trying to figure out, what's this whole infinity thing? Well, this brings people to God consciousness. And this is a part of the constituent makeup of man. And so as you're aware that there's got to be more to life, and yet you continue to just live life, as it were. People do. And not hopefully not positive believers, but other people out there, they just live life like God's never going to have. And see, deep down within all men, now they may not admit it, they may not acknowledge it, but because there's this little spark of eternity in their hearts, that in the soul of man, he knows about this. He also instinctively recognizes there's a day of judgment coming. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows that if there's eternity, this begs the question, well, is there a God who formed time? I mean, these bring up some fundamental questions about the nature of existence. And if there is a God, is there going to be a day of reckoning? And the answer is yes, of course there is. Even Solomon's going to acknowledge that, not because he's happy about it, but he's going to admit it. And you get into chapter 3, he will actually acknowledge here. Verse 17, I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. And there's a time for that judgment. There is a time for every matter and for every deed, is there? So instinctively, man knows God exists. He may not acknowledge it or admit it, but he knows it. I mean, I remember as a child growing up, I mean, you come to this recognition, well, okay, there's a God. Everybody does. Now, the agnostic says, oh, I don't know if there's a God. Yeah, you do. He's just lying to you. The atheist says there is no God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Why is he a fool? Because instinctively in his heart, he knows there is a God. God's put that spark there that makes him know there's a God. God's given a witness to himself, not only in the external factors of creation. As you look around at creation, this begs some big questions. How did we get here? Why does everything work the way it does? Why are there these regular patterns, day and night, and all of that? Well, the Bible answers all those questions if people would care to accept it. And why is this the only planet in the universe that's habitable? Well, we're not sure. I'm sure. There is no other planet out there that's habitable. There's this one. This is where it all focuses. Why is the focus here on Earth? How did we get here? I mean, fundamental questions that man has to ask. Any thinking person asks. And I remember, you know, before I was a believer, I would think about God and eternity and what's heaven like? What's endless time like? What do we do? See, for me as a little boy, I love playing baseball. I thought heaven had to be playing baseball every day. It doesn't get any better than that. I might not trip your trigger, but, you know, that was my view of, like, wow, you get to play baseball every day. Well, but I recognized the concept that heaven had to be a happy place. I didn't sit there and think, well, and then I would puzzle about eternity. And how long does it last? Well, it's a long time. And so all these things, men have to ask these things. And what is this big task, this evil task that men have? It's trying to make sense out of it all. But if you don't factor God into it, you never will make sense out of it all. And then if you don't obey God, even if you factored him into it, you're still never going to come to the proper conclusions. Even if you're a believer. If you're not positive at a certain point and you're not willing to do it God's way and humble yourself, you're never going to get there. That's just a fact. And God has worked it this way on purpose, apparently. He structured this thing so it works this way. And that gets to be another question. Well, who's responsible for all this? Fundamental questions that men have to ask. So he tries to get this task here, which he calls grievous, of trying to put it all together. Well, it is burdensome trying to put it all together with human wisdom. It is oppressive because it can't be done. It's constantly leading to a sense of frustration. And if you don't smell frustration in this book by now, can you smell what Solomon's been cooking? Frustration. And the idea here is that he's just sick of it all. Why? Well, he hasn't factored God into any of it. And you're not going to come to these, And what does all this do? All of this just drives the person essentially to God. If you're going to get it, you're going to have to admit God exists. He knows what he's doing. He's got a plan. And he controls things. And he's got a much bigger perspective than we do. And he lives outside the realm of time and space. And his plan's eternal. So you can't judge it. Not effectively. Because you'd have to be eternal to judge it. You'd have to see the whole thing. And when you do see the whole thing, eventually, at some point, you're going to say the knowledge and the wisdom of God. God did all this and he did it right. He did everything absolutely right. And you're going to be so impressed when you get there. And that's what we saw. What are these angels and all these creatures in Revelation, what are they doing? They're worshiping the eternal God. By your decree, everything exists. and they all have life. And all people have to admit, just as Satan has to admit. He may not want to admit it. But you know, deep down, that there was a point where you became aware of your existence. There was a point where you didn't exist, and there was a point where you did exist. Now, once you exist, can you feature another point where you don't exist again? And the answer is, in the heart of man, he knows, no, like, there's something about life that there's no end to it. And so they want, then of course, from the human viewpoint, though, well, we're just like dogs. We die, we go to sleep, and that's it. We never wake up. We just sleep. But even when you're asleep, are you really asleep? Aren't you dreaming sometimes? Aren't you consciously aware of things going on? I mean, consciously, you're asleep, I understand. But in your dreams, sometimes aren't you an actor, and sometimes aren't you a participant, and sometimes aren't you just an observer? And so you have this awareness, even when you're asleep, you still have an awareness about you. The mind doesn't totally shut off. And there's this idea of, well, how do you get, and this all, I mean, the fact that the day and night, even when you're sleeping, even when you're awake, that you never really are completely out of it at some level, you recognize, well, geez, does this ever stop? And I think deep down people know it doesn't. That's the whole eternity factor. Well, 17, the task, he characterized the task of wisdom as being grievous. Here he uses two equally negative words to define the life of the hard worker. And so the hard worker goes out there, people live life, they go through it, and they're trying to make sense of it all while they're doing it, and yet they never really arrive at a sense of it all. Apart from doctrine, you never ever will. And that is what is so satisfying about doing it right. There's a certain level of satisfaction that the negative unbeliever doesn't get, and the negative believer doesn't get, because they're not willing to do it God's way. And when you humble yourself and you're willing to do it God's way, God will bless you in all that, and there's a certain satisfaction and contentment that goes with that that's sadly and obviously lacking in this book to this point. Why? Because he hasn't been doing it God's way. He's been doing it his own way. And he had the money, time, wherewithal to do it his way. And nobody to stop him. He had nobody to answer to. He didn't have an authority. I mean, God was his authority, and that was it. There shouldn't be that much power in the hands of one man. Well, take it up with God. He engineered it. It's ultimately his plan. And these kings, and we saw that when we did the book of Daniel, that great statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. Daniel said, "You are the head of gold." And probably outside of Solomon and Nebuchadnezzar, power had never been concentrated into the hands of a single man to that level and to that extreme ever before or ever again that I know about. Nebuchadnezzar answered to nobody. Solomon answered to nobody. Obviously, they were supposed to answer to God. We know that. But they didn't. Nebuchadnezzar didn't for quite a while, and Solomon didn't during a certain period of his life. People think, well, does that make them happy? No. Having all that power, authority, fame, money, all those things, all the details, women, wine, song, entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. I got it all. Did it make them happy? No. No, because man can't get there on his own. That's another whole lesson in this whole book. You can't get there on your own. You've got to do it God's way. That's if you intend to succeed. Now, if you're happy being miserable, then okay, you're happy being miserable. I don't want to live that way. And so the idea here is this grievous task of trying to make sense out of it, put together the pieces that we find. It's everywhere. And it's funny because the more I've studied this book, even when I started studying it, suddenly it was like the lights went on around me in the world. And I see all these things in the music, in the TV shows, and all this stuff that Solomon's talking about. It's everywhere once you start looking. He admits it's pervasive out there, that it's there. So the first word here he used to describe this unpleasant part of it is painful, makov, which can be used of physical pain, but tends to unite the concepts of physical and mental anguish. That was our Exodus. We looked that verse up there, where the suffering of the Jews under the oppression of Egyptian captivity. There at the end of the 12th dynasty and going into the 13th. dynasty of Egypt. 19, the second term, ka'as, grievous, encompasses the ideas of vexation, provocation, anger, grief, and sorrow. It's a big term. Again, that irritation even you could put in there. So you've got pains and irritation. And I think there's a little bit of an autobiographical touch here too. Although, you know, he's talking in general terms, but this is how he feels. This is what his life is like. Well, is this how you want to live? Pains and irritation, agitation? Being provoked all the time? Well, that's the point you get to, though, when you run with the STA, though, isn't it? And we all, deep down, I think, know that. That there isn't any satisfaction in all of this out here, but when you're not doing it God's way, you can substitute all kinds of things for God's way and call it God's will, but it's not, and it'll be showed up for what it is. So 21, one might expect the life of a working man would be difficult, unfulfilling, and problematic. One anticipates a time when he can rest and recharge his batteries. 21, however, Koheleth points out that even during the night, which is also an accusative of time, such is not the case. 22, the literal Hebrew of verse 23 is that his heart will not lie down, which is designed to express the concept of restlessness and possibly even anxiety. And he's not talking, we might say here, so much about, I mean, we've all probably been through periods of testing and problems where, you know, you couldn't sleep because you were under pressure and all of that. I mean, I don't think that's so much what he's talking about specifically here as in more general terms. That even at night, he can't slow down. He can't turn his mind off. And again, probably all of us have spent at least a sleepless night, so you know what it's like, and it's not fun, is it? And so Solomon here, again, this restlessness, and again, possibly even anxiety. You know, you may be worried about the future, worried about the past, whatever, you're worried, you're thinking through it, and all that. And there comes a point where, but one of the things you see here, I would say this just screams no faith rest. Not faith resting and stuff. Again, one of the things, many things I see in this stuff, but a complete lack of faith, a complete lack of faith rest, and a complete miserable existence that's unfulfilling, and that's what you get. So at 23, at times people can become so frustrated and anxious over the events of the day, they effectively cannot get their minds to stop and rest. 24, so while man ultimately gets nothing for all his hard work that he can permanently call his own, he does obtain a lot of grief and pressure for his efforts. But is that viewed as satisfying? No, of course not. That's what he's getting at. It's not only you're going to lose it all, it's not even satisfying while you're getting it. So enjoy yourself. That's our message of encouragement today. Enjoy yourself because you're going to be miserable while you're getting it, and you're not going to take it with you. So, hopefully I'm doing a job, I think I am, of communicating how fed up he is with all this. How miserable he is under all of this. And again, if people want to live life under this kind of misery, power to them, go do it. I'm not interested. I've done it. Been there, done that. I'm not interested. I'll still make my own share of mistakes, but it won't be because of trying to live life apart from God and not being willing to humble myself and do it God's way. That mistake I don't make, generally speaking. I mean, I may fail on an isolated occasion, but I know where that lifestyle leads, and it leads to the misery we're looking at here. It leads to the frustration and the depression that we see in Solomon. So you have to relate things to God, faith rest things, when you're under times of pressure and difficulty. And all of that, and you'll find that God provides comfort, encouragement, peace, and all the things that the people are so wrapped around the axle about. And the person that faith rests it, well, they're calm in the eye of the storm. And it happens. So 25, his conclusion, as it had been for some time, is that this too is vanity. I would suggest that there is that here one could even understand Koheleth to mean that this is all insanity. I mean, there's a certain insanity to all this. If this is what life really is, this is insane. Why bother? the frustration, the misery, the depression, the hard work, all this, and you're going to leave it to somebody else. This is insane. Why mess with it? There's a certain insanity to that. Well, 26, in this section, Koheleth is obviously frustrated about the fact that one expected that hard work should bring some sort of lasting blessing, which is based on typical Hebrew wisdom. For instance, Proverbs 10:4. In some ways, as we've pointed out here, this book contrasts and acknowledges that there's another side of life beyond what we might call the traditional wisdom view. That, yes, is the traditional wisdom view true? Yes. But is there another truth out here too? Yes. Yes, there is. And in the traditional wisdom view, they didn't focus on the unpleasant, unfulfilling aspects of life. They focused on God and His blessing and all that. Proverbs 10:4. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So there was a certain strain of wisdom thought that said, if you go out and work hard, God blesses diligent labor, and that he will prosper you at a certain level financially, that he won't prosper the lazy person, the person that works with a slack hand. All people have all kinds of reasons for why they can't work hard. I'm not interested in hearing any of them. They're nothing more than excuses as far as I'm concerned. Everybody can work hard. And people that don't, they're just lazy. There's no other explanation. They're just lazy. And again, in many cases, these are the takers, not the givers. The takers tend to be lazy people too. Also, Proverbs 12:24. Someone would say, well, okay, yeah, if you work hard, you get rich. Solomon's going to say, I've seen wise men end up, you know, with nothing. But that's not what traditional wisdom would have said. Proverbs 12:24, the hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. So, you know, you can end up as a slave if you're lazy, because you're not worthy. Well, first, you're not worthy of being in charge. Also, 13:4, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the soul of the diligent is made fat. And again, fat here being a figure for prosperity. It's not a bad term, of course, you know, in our bulimic society. Fat's a bad term. It's not a bad term. It's prosperous. The soul of the diligent is made prosperous. He prospers. He has more than he needs. That's the idea of fat. Fat is in excess of what you need. And traditional wisdom literature would say, look, God's behind all this, and God likes hard work, and so you work hard and God will bless you. Now, is that true? Yes. On the other hand, are there people that work hard and they don't seem to get anywhere? Sure. Sure there are. Of course there are. So also here, the last one, 21:5. So Solomon acknowledges the other side of this, though. There's a certain, even hard work and all that, doesn't always guarantee success. Just as wisdom doesn't always guarantee success. It has the advantage in that it gives success, but does it guarantee success? And he would argue in Ecclesiastes, no. While traditional wisdom literature would argue, yes, yes it does. Wisdom always makes you successful. Proverbs 21:5, the plans of the diligent surely lead to advantage, but everyone who is hasty surely comes to poverty. And I watch these people in their jump and run mentality. Don't think through things. Don't pray about it. Jump and run. And guess what? They're headed down a path that will lead to some problems. I've seen it happen to them too. Wait a minute. What is it about this that we have to do right now that can't just wait 5 minutes to think about it, pray about it, consult God on the matter? No, you got to jump now. Yeah. You know, it's an old car salesman deal. You know, if you buy, you'll sign right now. But you got to do it today. Can't come, this car won't be here tomorrow. Got to do it today. Got to sign in. The old Hudeberg Chevrolet, you ought to buy now. Commercial. You know, wait a second. What's the big rush all of a sudden? And I see these people, and they're lungers. They lunge. And when they keep lunging, they're going to get burned for it. Trust me, it's going to jump up and bite them one day. And I see people that suffer, and sometimes they're suffering financially because they lunged. Why do you suffer financially? You lunged. You made a bad decision, didn't think about it, didn't pray about it, didn't consult God. It looked good, so you jumped on it. And that hastiness, that's a form of stupidity. It's from bad, that leads to bad decision making. Well, 27, the hard worker does not find his task easy during the day and does not receive any comfort or ease at night. 28, the daily grind goes on and on. While the worker may prosper in his endeavors, or he may become completely frustrated, and you've probably had that, maybe you've had both of those experiences in your life, that hard work has led to prosperity and advancement and all that, and other times hard work leads to nothing. So then the logical question becomes, well, why work hard? Since there's no sure outcome to this, why work hard? That would become the next logical question. He is still destined, no matter what, though, whether he dies a frustrated, broken person or whether he dies a rich, happy person, as it were, he's destined to leave it all to someone else. Doesn't matter. In the end, in the final analysis, it doesn't matter. So essentially, point 29, there is nowhere to go from here logically. Either one should stop working altogether or just possibly end it all and get it over with. I mean, those to me look to be the only two logical conclusions to this depressing view. If this is the way it is, hard work, misery, no rest, no respite from all this. This is all you got to look forward to. And by the way, it never gets any better than this. What if this is as good as it gets? And this, he's saying, this is as good as it gets. That's his viewpoint on this. This is as good as it gets. And this is all you can expect. So, okay, why work then? Why even bother? Just go out and live on the streets and don't be responsible for anybody except just making sure you get from one meal to the next. That's all you need to do. Or alternately, just put a bullet in your brain, get it over with. But if this was my view of life, I mean, this is a kind of view of the life that would make you want to put a bullet in your brain. But again, underneath all this, this misery, this despair, all this, Solomon is still positive. And he's going to pull out of this. But, and sometimes God lets people go out there and take themselves to the bottom. Take yourself to the bottom. When you get to the bottom, all you're going to find out is that the bottom is there. And there's nowhere to go but up, or else stay on the bottom. Those are your two choices. But if you're going to ever come out of your spiritual tailspin, if Solomon's ever going to come out of his spiritual tailspin, he's got to get back to orienting to God and his plan. He can't just keep doing it his own way. This has led him to this point. And if you're ever going to recover spiritually, there's got to be a huge humbling process to go on. And so Solomon, at some point, we don't know when or how or where. I don't think he alludes to it in this book, as far as I know. Now, I might find it. But he doesn't really tell us when he decided to pull out of it. But he does pull out of it. And that's kind of, again, the whole subject of the book is, hey, I got to rock bottom here. I got to here. And if you look at his views on life, I would certainly hope everybody here would acknowledge, yeah, he's a dead bottom here. There's nowhere else to go now. I mean, it's either just kill yourself, stay at the bottom, or, move up. And how long do you want to live down there at the bottom? It's not a pleasant place, is it? I don't want to live there. So again, essentially, there's nowhere to go logically now. You either got, or something's got to happen here. And that something is, you've got to start factoring God into it and get back to doing it God's way. Get back to doing it the way of doctrine. Stop these deviations that people advance and espouse. And that's exactly what I said 6 months ago. It's time we get back to get with it or get out. This was the doctrine, at a certain level, you've got to, as a believer, you've got to do it for yourself. Nobody can do it for you. You've got to do it for yourself. And if you can't do it for yourself, well, I can't do it for you. No matter how much I care about you, no matter how much I love you, no matter how good a teacher I am, no matter how much I pray for you, I can't do it for you. You have to do it for yourself. You have to choose to lock into God's plan, make the decisions, humble yourself under his mighty hand, and do the things that you have to do that you know are doctrinally correct. And so that's where it's got to go. Either that or we can stay at the bottom. I don't care to. So 30, while this is written in a general fashion to include all men, it seems evident that this is somewhat autobiographical. Koheleth knows these realities in his own life. He's keenly aware of this, I think. Or was keenly aware of it. As he writes, you know, later on, he looks back now and he sees this miserable person that he was. And he doesn't attempt to hide it or smooth it over or whitewash it or say, oh, well, it wasn't that bad. I think everything in this chapter screams it was that bad and worse. And he doesn't attempt to hide all this. So obviously he's quite humble about this now, I think. But that's the thing with pride and arrogance. When God humbles you, then, you know, okay, I'll tell you what I did. I was stupid. I went and did this and such and blah, blah, blah. And obviously you want it to be edifying. It's not necessarily wise to share every blunder you made. You don't want to drag people down by it. But his purpose here is not dragging people down. He's just pointing out to you, this is what I did and this is where it led. So don't, without coming out and saying it, he's saying, don't do it this way. Don't do it the way I did it. But isn't that what all people tell me, you know, do as I say, not as I did? Or not as I do? At a certain level, you have to tell people, hey, yeah, there are things I would change. I think he looks back, I'm sure, with some regret, and looks at all this and says, well, I would change. And so what's the best I can do now? Well, I can't go back and change the past. That I cannot do. I cannot undo the past. And the wise believer learns to recognize that and live in the moment. You can beat yourself up all day long for things you do or did. But it's not why, you know, certainly anything pre-salvation, you just need to completely blot out of your mind. It doesn't even exist to God at that level. Because we all probably think back. I mean, I'm sure you can. Think back to dumb things you did before you were a believer. Then you got, you know, then the whole dumb things I did after I was a believer category. But you can't change those either. So living in the past or agonizing over the past, what can Solomon do? Well, I can't change any of this. I am who I am, he says, essentially. But what I can do is write a book, a letter here, a little treatise, and without being preachy, try to help other people avoid what I went through. And that's the best you can do as a teacher sometimes. You can't make them avoid it. You can't live it for them. But you just do your best to get them to look. Do it the way I'm saying here because I know what I'm talking about. And you don't want to come across as preachy or I'm better than you or any of that. I don't think Solomon at this point in his life, I don't think he thinks he's better than anybody. And the wise person doesn't think they're better than anybody. You just, you know, hey, I've been there, done that. Please pay attention. I can save you some wear and tear in your life. And I think as you get older spiritually, and as you grow up and all of that, the whole point is you actually do care about people. You can't just turn it on and off. And you'd like to see people make it. You'd like to see them be positive, make right good decisions. But then that's the pain of the lupe that you have to, just like Paul did. You have your Hymenaeus and your Alexander. You have these other people that are following them and listening to them. And, you know, I don't think Paul delighted in any of that. You got your incestuous Corinthian. And these three examples I cite because these are the ones that Paul turned over to Satan. They've been delivered over to the devil. And the goal, of course, was remedial. So turn it loose on them, God. Let Satan have them. Let him do with them what he wants. And let's see if they enjoy this. And, of course, what history says, the 2 Corinthians deal, is the incestuous Corinthian responded to it and came back. There's no evidence that Hymenaeus and Alexander did. Hymenaeus appears to be mentioned about 3 or 4 years later in the book to 2 Timothy, or 5 possibly even. And he still seems to be, you know, on his deal out there promoting his false doctrine that the resurrection's already happened. And, you know, scaring people, freaking them out. You know, that's what happens with false doctrine. It freaks people out, upsets them, and it should. It doesn't create unity, it creates division. A false doctrine never does anything other than that. It upsets people, creates division. And so Paul had his, though. He had his Lupe list, a long one, I'm sure. You read his letter at the end there to 2 Timothy, right before he's getting ready to be executed. And he says, everybody has abandoned me. I can't believe that's fun or pleasant. Demas, having loved this present world, has forsaken me. He became a worldling. He's a believer, a positive believer at one time. But he's gone now. So you can't deal with all that. You can't look in the past. Well, you agonize over it. You can't beat yourself up at a certain level. You just got to move on. You have all these things happen. And so what's the best thing Solomon can do? Well, I'll write a little letter. Maybe it'll help somebody else. Maybe the teaching will help somebody else. I know about this. I've been there, done it. And the more I even study this book, you know, at first when I started it, I thought, God, this is God-awful. But the more I look at it in the whole big scheme of things and what his intentions are and what all is really going on, I think this is one of those books, if you just read it on the surface, you're going to look at it and think, what? This contradicts doctrine. This is so ungodly. This is what? And I mean, that's your initial, that was my initial response to it. There's so many contradictions in here. And I think he's giving us a very real slice of life, a slice of his life. And we're gonna. It's not as though, and I think I finally figured out. I'm not absolutely certain, but we actually start to hear the voice of the older, wiser Solomon in chapter 5, when he starts to give advice, and he gives advice from his perspective then, of course, not from the younger guy. And he starts. And what's his first advice? You better be careful when you approach the house of God. That's his first. Much of his advice focuses, of course, on God and how you're going to relate to Him. Because that's really the end of all wisdom, isn't it? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the end of wisdom. So he gives you this autobiography, sort of through, I believe, the first four chapters. And then he jumps back and forth after that. You'll hear the voice of the older, wiser Solomon. And he'll make some allusions to things he thought back before that, too. But you start to hear that voice, I think, again, as far as I can tell, my first instincts are that it's in chapter 5. So 31, if there is no more to life than Koheleth has presented throughout this chapter, then life as he has presented it is not really worth living. If this is all true, if this is the way it is, one would have to acknowledge that life isn't worth living. And do you find yourself sometimes as you're sitting here in class or thinking about, hopefully you think about this outside of class too, do you find yourself thinking, you know, I don't really think that way about life? That you might take issue with some of the things he says here. That they might be true at a certain level, but at another level, no, they're not. Life isn't just these horrible, god-awful things. But it is if you run with the STA. That's all it becomes. It's just a form of living death. And people out there that are out of fellowship, won't forgive, bitter, all that, they're just living death. They may be believers, obviously believers, but they're living in temporal death, and that's where they're stuck until they can get over it. So 32, however, as we shall see, there are other factors in life that he has not mentioned or brought to bear. And we will get next time, we only got about 5 minutes, so I don't want to jump into this. Koheleth begins now, finally, at some point. Once you hit rock bottom, where are you going to go? Well, when you look up, there's God. You know, in spite of all this horrible, God-awful misery, you look up and God's still there. Even in spite of your miserable, wretched existence. And at some point, if you don't start relating it to God, well, you'll stay there at the bottom. That's the only option you have. All right, well, we will pick up there and dive into this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls in Christ's name. Amen.